fourth lecture, titled Money, Prices and Inflation. I've included this lecture as the background for tomorrow's lecture on the Christian view of debt and usury and inflation. In our model of gross national product, national income, spending depended largely on the incomes people received. But we receive our incomes in the form of money, and somehow it seems that money must be too important to leave out. So in this lecture we shall discuss the part played by money in our highly complex industrialized economy. Since spending does appear to depend largely on incomes received, we need to ask how more or less money will raise or lower incomes. But first, what is money? The functions of money. First, we may think of money as a medium of exchange. Money overcomes the difficulties of barter by serving as a general medium of exchange or means of payment. Money is something that everybody is prepared to accept in exchange for goods and services. A person will accept money in payment because he knows other people in turn will accept it from him in return for the goods and services he himself requires. Underline the next sentence. Hence, money can be defined as a generally acceptable means of payment. It is something everybody is willing to accept in payment of goods or services or in settlement of a debt. When this aspect of money is considered, the monetary unit is called a unit of currency because it runs from hand to hand. In an introduction to Christian economics, Gary North points out money is different from any other commodity. Quote, one thing which distinguishes money from all other commodities is that it is not used up through consumption. It is desired for the things which can be purchased with it, either now or at some future date. But why should one commodity, gold for example, be preferred by people for use as money rather than some other economic good? It is because some commodities possess the four basic properties that all monetary commodities must have. First, money must be durable. It would be hard to use ground beef as money, since it spoils too fast. Second, money must be transportable. Third, it should be divisible into equal parts for the purpose of accurate counting. Gold dust used to serve this purpose during the gold rush days in California and Alaska. Bags of salt still function as money in some parts of Africa. And fourth, money must be relatively scarce. This is extremely important. If money were as plentiful as, for example, air, it would no longer function as money. End of quote. Money, then, is a medium of exchange that helps trade in goods and services. Wherever people have progressed beyond simple barter, they have used their most marketable goods as media of exchange. In primitive societies, they used cattle or salt, fish, and even women. In the early civilizations, where the division of labor extended to larger areas, gold and silver emerged as the most marketable good, and finally, as the only medium of exchange, called money. Of this use of gold and silver as the medium of exchange, Murray Rothbard writes in What Has Government Done to Our Money, quote, through the centuries, two commodities, gold and silver, have emerged as money in the free competition of the market, and have displaced the other commodities. Both are uniquely marketable, are in great demand as ornaments. This process, the cumulative development of a medium of exchange on the free market, is the only way money can become established. Money cannot originate in any other way, neither by everyone suddenly deciding to create money out of useless material, nor by the government calling bits of paper money. For embedded in the demand for money is knowledge of the money prices of the immediate past, in contrast to directly used consumers or producers' goods. Money must have pre-existing prices on which to ground a demand. But the only way this can happen is by beginning with a useful commodity under barter, and then adding demand for a medium to the previous demand for direct use. Thus, the government is powerless to create money for the economy. It can only be developed by the processes of the free market. The most important truth about money now emerges from our discussion. Underline, money is a commodity. Learning this simple lesson is one of the world's most important tasks. Money is not an abstract unit of account, divorceable from a concrete good. It is not a useless token, only good for exchanging. It is not a claim on society. It is not a guarantee of a fixed price level. It is simply a commodity. It differs from other commodities in being demanded mainly as a medium of exchange. But aside from this, it is a commodity, and like all commodities, it has an existing stock. It faces demand by people to buy and hold it. Like all commodities, its price in terms of other goods is determined by the interaction of its total supply or stock and the total demand by people to buy and hold it. People buy money by selling their goods and services for it, just as they sell money when they buy goods and services. Secondly, we may think of money as a store of value. Money also serves as a convenient form in which we can store our income so it need not be spent immediately upon receipt. It makes saving easier and facilitates long-term planning and projects. This function of money widens the range of choices available to us in deciding what we are going to purchase. The holder of money, because it is generally accepted and fixed in price, is provided with a store of value or general purchasing power, which he can spend when, where, for what, and with whom he sees fit. By holding wealth in the form of money, the person is assured of means with which to meet unpredictable emergencies or to pay debts as they become due. And as they're providing, inflation does not destroy it. That is a very important qualification. Providing inflation does not destroy the value of the money being stored. Thirdly, we may think of money as a standard or measure of value. Money is a unit in which the value of goods and services is expressed as a price. When something comes to serve as a generally accepted means of exchange, it is natural to express values, to make contracts, to keep accounts in terms of that something. The use of money as a measure of value immensely facilitates economic calculation. The monetary unit for purposes of calculation is called the unit of account. And finally, we may think of money as a standard of deferred payment. Contracts, including loans, are usually made in terms of money. This is because people believe the purchasing power of money is not likely to change much during the period of the contract. If they fear that it will, then they'll make contracts in terms of something else, for example, gold or Swiss dollars, if they usually deal in sterling. Now, what is the origin of money's value? People seek money because it has purchasing power. And part of this purchasing power is generated by the people's demand for money. But this is not reasoning in a circle. It is not. According to Ludwig von Mises in Human Action, we must be mindful of the time factor. Our quest for cash holdings is conditioned by our experience of the purchasing power of money in the immediate past, which in turn was affected by earlier purchasing power, and so on, until we arrive at the very inception of the monetary demand. At that particular moment, the purchasing power of a certain quantity of gold or silver was determined by its non-monetary uses only. This leads to the interesting conclusion that the universal use of paper monies today, what is called government printed fiat money, would be inconceivable without their prior use as substitutes for real money, for example, silver and gold, for which there was a non-monetary demand. Only when people grew accustomed to these substitutes and governments deprived them of their freedom to employ gold and silver as needed of exchange, did state-produced legal tender money emerge as the legal fiat money. Such token money has purchasing power, although it lacks any non-monetary demand, because people now direct their monetary demand towards such government paper money. If for any reason this public demand should cease or be redirected toward real goods as means of exchange, the government fiat money would lose its entire value. The continental dollar and various foreign currencies over the years illustrate this point. When any form of money becomes inoperative, as when the total issue of the paper currency in Germany rose from 50 billion marks in December of 1919 to 496 quadrillion marks in December of 23, it must eventually be replaced by another form. Now we come to the nature and reasons for inflation. During most of the 20th century, inflation has been a normal state of affairs. In the United States, price increases have so outweighed price declines that the dollar now buys only a small fraction of what it could have bought at the start of the century. Please have a look at the graph at the end of the lecture. Consumer price index. As the consumer price index has continuously gone up, so, as you can imagine, the purchasing power of the consumer dollar has gone down. So what you could buy in 1900 has really gone way down. It's absolutely awful. Notice the part played, of course, by the various wars. Just to sort of hold your finger there, and I'll give you the explanation. Now just look at these two graphs, please. A consumer, for example, $1 in 1967 could only buy about one-fourth of what he could have bought with $1 in 1900. That is, the dollar in 1900 was worth four 1967 consumer dollars. The second graph, that's on the one on the right, shows that consumer prices have been rising throughout most of the 20th century. The rise in prices has been most rapid during wartime periods. The most prolonged decline in prices took place during the Great Depression. Most economists are in agreement that the inflation in the United States during the past 5 years has been the worst since the early 1940s, taking account of both severity and duration. And as you may know, during the first 5 months of this year, the inflation rate is now running at the appalling figure of 12%. But they cannot agree on the nature of the inflation that is engulfing the American economy, nor upon the reasons for it. We may distinguish three main schools of thought. The first school argues that inflation means a rise in consumer prices. Thus, Professor Paul Samuelson, in economics, his famous textbook, which we use at Dort, defines inflation as follows. By inflation, we mean a time of generally rising prices for goods and factors of production, rising prices for bread, cars, haircuts, rising wages, rents, etc. By deflation, we mean a time when most prices and costs are falling. End of quote. The second school sees inflation as an excessive aggregate demand for goods and services. Too much money chasing too few goods and services. The third school sees inflation as due to the creation of too much token government fiat money and too much increase in the economy's supply of money by the commercial banks. Thus, Murray Rothbard defines inflation, quote, as any increase in the economy's stock of money not consisting of an increase in the stock of the money metal. Fractional reserve banks, therefore, are inherently inflationary institutions. Commenting on this definition, Gary North writes, inflation means any increase in the economy's supply of money, period. Thus, the level of prices is not the criterion in determining whether or not inflation is present. The only relevant factor is simply whether any new money is being injected into the system, be it gold, silver, credit, or paper. Ludwig von Mises argues in his symposium, Defense, Controls, and Inflation, defining inflation in terms of the tendency of all prices to rise rather than in terms of an increase in the quantity of money is to mistake the symptom for the disease. He says, "There is nowadays a very reprehensible, even dangerous semantic confusion that makes it extremely difficult for the non-expert to grasp the true state of affairs. Inflation, as this term was always used everywhere, and especially also in this country, means increasing the quantity of money and banknotes in circulation and of bank deposits subject to check. But people today call inflation the phenomenon that is the inevitable consequence of inflation, that is, the tendency of all prices and wage rates to rise. The result of this deplorable confusion is there is no term left to signify the cause of this rise in prices and wages. It follows that nobody cares about inflation in the traditional sense of the term. We cannot talk about something that has no name, and we cannot fight it. Those who pretend to fight inflation are, in fact, only fighting what is the inevitable consequence," underline that word, consequence, "of inflation. Their ventures are doomed to failure because they do not attack the root of the evil. They try to keep prices low while firmly committed to a policy which must necessarily make them soar. As long as this terminological confusion is not entirely wiped out, there cannot be any question of stopping inflation." Now, what kinds and types of inflation are there? Economists distinguish several different types of inflation, depending on the speed at which it takes place and the conditions that appear to have generated it. The most rapid type of inflation is called hyperinflation. In hyperinflation, even the daily increases in wages and prices are noticeable. Such a type of inflation is characterized by snowballing effect. Instead of steady increases in prices, the percentage rise in the price levels multiplies rapidly. The classic example of such hyperinflation occurred in Germany after World War I. Between December of 1919 and December of 23, Germany's wholesale price index rose from 0.803 to that enormous figure I give you. I suppose you'd call it 1,200,000,000,000, either quadrillion or trillion, 400 billion. The type of inflation we have experienced in the United States is called creeping inflation. This term usually refers to a rate of inflation that is less than a 5% increase in price level. In 1971, the United States experienced a rise in price levels at the rate of about 4% per year. In 73, this had climbed to about 5%. Such a yearly rise in prices may sound insignificant, but this is to ignore the cumulative effects of creeping inflation. A yearly rise in prices of 3% means that in only 23 years, prices will have doubled. Economists also distinguish two types of inflation based on the circumstances that stimulate the cycles of wage and price increases. When an economy is operating at full employment, any increase in spending will be inflationary. Businesses cannot increase the supply of goods to meet the increased demand. Instead, buyers will bid up the prices of the limited output. Such inflation is commonly called demand-pull inflation. The American economy experienced demand-pull inflation right after World War II. During the war, few consumer goods had been produced. Families postponed many purchases because of the unavailable goods. After the war ended, the demand for goods shot up, but production still lacked. So eager buyers bid up the prices on the limited quantity of goods available, and inflation began. In recent years, economists have become increasingly interested in a different type of inflation, cost push. When businesses are faced with higher costs of resource inputs, typically due to wage and salary hikes, that are greater than increases in productivity, warrants, they push prices up. This leads to corresponding demand by labor unions for even higher wages so that workers can have an increase in real buying power. Another type of cost-push inflation is caused by the attempt of business firms to gain an increased profit margin by raising prices. As, for example, the oil companies in the last few months. Are this attempt to blame business firms and labor unions for the nation's inflation, Gary North writes, "The traditional debate over the so-called wage-price spiral misses the mark completely. The unions blame management for the increasing cost of all manufactured goods, while business blames the union as the cause of the price hike, since added labor costs force management to pass along the wage increases to the consumers." Underline the next point. Both groups are wrong. Without the counterfeit, unbacked credit money produced by fractional reserve banking, without the unbacked treasury notes, neither labor nor business could continually force up prices. Labor would price itself out of the market, forcing management to fire some of the laborers. Business would price their products too high, and the public would shift to their competitors. No, the wage price spiral is only a symptom of the inflation. It is a direct result, not the cause of inflation. Admittedly, government coercion backing up labor's demands have made the unions a major source of the pressures keeping costs rising continually. As Henry Hazlitt argues in What You Should Know About Inflation. But this should not blind us to the original causes, the treasuries counterfeiting and the governmentalist protected fractional reserve banking system, it should be. Banking. End of quote. Since the issue of the impact of collective bargaining on inflation can be argued in several different ways in the abstract, the critical need is for facts and measurement. Ideally, we'd have to compare existing wage levels with those that would prevail in the absence of labor unions. A number of attempts have been made to resolve this question. After summarizing all relevant statistical evidence, including 12 separate industry studies, Professor H.G. Lewis concluded in his book, Unionism and Relative Wages in the United States, that the average wage of union labor exceeded the average non-union wage by 25% or more in the mid-30s under depression conditions, but only by less than 5% in the period of the rapid inflation during 45-49 and by 10-15% in the late 1950s. The demand and supply of money. The arguments over the nature and reasons of inflation cannot be resolved unless we first understand the forces determining the demand and supply of money. The purchasing power of money is determined by the demand for and the supply of money, just like the prices of all other economic goods and services. The particular relation between this demand and supply determines its particular purchasing power. So we need to look at those factors that exert an influence on the demand and supply side of money. Let us look at the demand side first. As money is a medium of exchange, our demand for it may be influenced by considerations of facts and circumstances either on the good side of the exchange or on the money side. Therefore, we may speak of goods-induced factors and money-induced factors. A simple example may illustrate the former. Let us assume we live in a medieval town that is cut off from all fresh supplies by an enemy army. There is great want and starvation. Although the quantity of money did not change, no gold or silver has left our town, its purchasing power must decline. For now, everyone seeks to reduce his cash holdings in exchange for some scarce food in order to assure survival. The situation is similar in all cases, where the supply of available goods is decreased, although the quantity of money in the people's cash holdings remains unchanged. In a war, when the channels of supply are cut off by the enemy, or economic output is reduced for lack of labor power, the value of money tends to decline, and the price of goods rises, even though the quantity of money may remain unchanged. A bad harvest in a farming economy may visibly weaken the currency. Also, a general strike that paralyzes an economy and greatly reduces the supply of goods and services, raises the prices of such goods, and simultaneously lowers the purchasing power of money. In fact, every strike or sabotage of economic production tends to affect prices and money value, even though it may not be visible. There is therefore a very definite connection between the purchasing power of money, underline this, and the available supply of goods and services. In other words, provided production is increasing, there is no need to fear inflation if the money supply remains constant, as if a hike showed in prices and production, an elastic currency is not necessary for a thriving economy, but in fact is harmful to stable prices, production, and employment. Some economists also cite the level of taxation as an important factor in the determination of the exchange value of money. According to Colin Clark, whenever governments consume more than 25% of gross national product, the reduction in productive capacity as a result of such oppressive tax burden causes the price of goods to rise and the purchasing power of money to fall. According to that view, with which one may disagree, high rates of taxation are the main cause of inflation. At any rate, there can be no doubt the American dollar has suffered severely from the burdens of federal, state, and local government spending and taxes that now exceeds 35% of America's gross national product. Yet this purchasing power loss of the dollar would have been greater by far if a remarkable rise in industrial productivity had not worked in the opposite direction. In spite of the ever-growing burden of government, and despite the tremendous increase in the supply of various forms of money, both of which would reduce the value of the dollar, American commerce and industry have managed to increase the supply of marketable goods, thus bolstering the dollar's purchasing power. Under very difficult conditions, businessmen have managed to form more capital investment and improve production technology, and thus made available more and better economic goods, which in turn have helped to stabilize the dollar. Without this remarkable achievement by American business and capitalists, the U.S. dollar would surely have followed the way of many other national currencies to radical depreciation and devaluation. Now, factors on the side of money. There are also a number of factors that affect the demand for money on the money side of the exchange. A growing population, for instance, with millions of maturing individuals eager to establish cash holdings, generates new demand, which in turn tends to raise the purchasing power of money and to reduce the price of goods. On the other hand, the declining population would generate the opposite effect. Changes in the division of labor bring about changes in the exchange value of money. Increased specialization and trade raises the demand and exchange value of money. The 19th century frontier farmer who tamed the West was largely self-sufficient. His demand for money was small when compared with that of his great-grandson. Under a modern and highly advanced division of labor, one needs more money for the satisfaction of all his wants through exchange. It is obvious that demand tends to raise the exchange value of money. And development and improvement of a monetary clearing system also exerts an influence towards lower money value. Clearing operations means offsetting payments by banks or brokers. It reduces the demand for money as only net balances are settled by cash payments. Business practices, too, may influence the demand for money, and so its value. It is customary for business to settle its obligations on the first day of the month. Tax payments are due on certain dates. The growing popularity of credit cards reduces the need for money holdings throughout the month, but concentrates it at the beginning when payments fall due. All such variations in demand affect the objective exchange values of money. Now, the desire of individuals for larger or smaller holdings of money. The most important determinant of the purchasing power of money under the heading of money-induced factors is the very attitude of the people toward money and their possession of certain cash holdings. They may decide for various reasons to increase or decrease their cash holdings. An increase in cash holdings tends to raise the exchange value of money, reductions of cash holdings to lower it. But this is so well understood, even the mathematical economists emphasize the money velocity in their equations and calculations of money value. The velocity of circulation is defined as the average number of times in a year which a dollar serves as income, that is, the number of times it's spent, or as an expenditure, the transaction's velocity. Of course, this economic use of a term borrowed from physics ignores acting man, who increases or decreases his cash holdings. The mathematical economist, who weighs and measures, and so ignores the choices and preferences of real people, is tempted to control and manipulate this philosophy in order to influence the value of money. He may even blame individuals who refuse to act in accordance with his model for monetary depreciation or appreciation. And governments are only too eager to echo this blame, even while they are creating ever new quantities of printing press money. They will restrain individuals in order to control money velocity, that is, by raising the bank rate. This is what's happening right now. It is true the propensity to increase or reduce cash holdings by many people exerts an important influence on the purchasing power of money. But in order to radically change their holdings, individuals must have cogent reasons. They try to lower their holdings whenever they foresee depressions ahead. They usually lower their holdings whenever they anticipate more inflation and declining money value. They tend to react rationally to certain governmental policies. Government cannot change or prevent this reaction. It can merely change its own policies that draw forth the reaction. No determinate demand, whether it affects the good side of exchange or the money side, is subject to such wide variations as is the supply of money. During the age of the gold coin standard, when gold coins were circulating freely, the supply of money was narrowly circumscribed by the supply of gold. But today, when governments have complete control over money and banking, when central banks can create money or withdraw money at will, the quantity of money changes significantly from year to year, even from week to week. The student of money and banking must now carefully watch the official statistics of money supply in order to understand current economic trends. Of course, the ever-changing supply of money must not be viewed as a factor that evenly and uniformly changes the level of prices and goods. The total supply of money in a given economy does not confront the total supply of goods. Changes in money supply always act through the cash holdings of individuals who react to changes in their personal incomes and to changing interest rates in the loan market. It is through acting individuals that supply changes exert their influences on various good prices. In our country, we have two monetary authorities that continually change the money supply: the United States Treasury and the Federal Reserve System. And there I give you some figures to show just how much money came into being from these two sources. In June of 29, $1.3 billion. By August of 2069, 58.2. And as we'll see later on in the course, that has now gone up tremendously. These figures reveal the nature and extent of the inflation that has engulfed us since the early 1930s. The 1940s and again the 1960s and early 1970s stand out as periods of the most rapid inflation and credit expansion. Now, next week we'll be dealing in more detail with how the government goes about creating money. Here I want to simply stress that it's this fact alone which explains why ours is an age of inflation and money destruction. The government is engaged in counterfeiting money, and it gets away with it because of a gullible American public. Now, what are the effects of this tremendous increase in the money supply upon our people? Turn over the page, please, to page 7. When more and more people begin to realize what the government is up to with its financial trickery, and that inflation is a willful government policy which will not end very soon, they may react by reducing their cash holdings. Why should they hold cash that depreciates? Why should they not buy more goods and services right now before prices rise again? This reaction intensifies the price-raising effects of the inflation. While government inflates and the people reduce their money demand, goods prices will rise rapidly and the purchasing power of money decline accordingly. It may happen the government may temporarily halt its inflation, yet the people continue to reduce their cash demand. The central bank inflators then point to the stability of the money supply and blame the people for irrational behavior and reaction. The government thus exculpates itself and condemns the spending habits of the people for the inflation. But in reality, the people react to past experiences of the government chicanery and so anticipate an early return of inflationary policies. The monetary developments during most 1972, please change 69-72, reflected the situation. And finally, people may totally and irrevocably distrust the official fiat money. When in desperation they finally conclude the inflation will not end before their money is essentially destroyed, they may rush to liquidate their remaining cash holdings. When any purchase of goods and services is more advantageous than holding rapidly depreciating cash, the value of money approaches zero. The money then ceases to be money, the sole medium of exchange. When government takes control of a money then, it not only takes possession of an important command post over the economic lives of the people, but also acquires a lucrative source of revenue. Under the ever-growing pressures for government services and functions, this source of revenue, which can be made to flow quietly without too much notice by the public, constitutes a great temptation for weak administrators who like to spend money without raising it through unpopular taxation. The supply of money is not only the best indicator as to the value of money, but also reflects the state of the nation and the thinking of the people. When a nation or people begin living beyond its immediate means of production, it starts to mortgage its future, and unless the rot is stopped, is doomed to eventual decay and collapse. Money rightly used by government and people can be a source of great blessing. When it is abused, it becomes a curse. As prices shoot up sharply and unevenly during inflation, all normal economic relationships are disrupted. Businessmen don't know what to charge for their products. Consumers don't know what to pay. Money becomes hot because inflation is rapidly diminishing the purchasing power of the dollar. In extreme cases, inflation may become so severe as to render the money supply virtually worthless. Resource suppliers will want to be paid in kind. Creditors will hide from debtors to escape the repayment of debt with cheap money. Money will cease to do its job as a means of exchange and standard of value. Nor will people want to store their wealth in the form of money. The economy will literally be thrown into a state of barter. As inflation increases in severity, businesses may find it more profitable to hoard both materials and finished products, awaiting further price increases. But by further restricting the availability of materials and products relative to the demand for them, such action will merely tend to intensify the inflationary pressure. Production and exchange grind to a halt, and the net result is economic, social, and political chaos, as happened in Germany during the Weimar Republic in 1930-32. Hyperinflation has precipitated monetary collapse, depression, and socio-political disorder. Thus, those who advocate mild inflation as a cure-all for unemployment are playing with fire. Such a policy of the New Economist is a very risky foundation for achieving healthy economic progress. Many nations have found from bitter experience that so-called mild inflations have got out of control and broke into galloping inflation with disastrous results. we may conclude that the creeping inflation advocated by such economists today as Galbraith and Samuelson can be expansionary for a short while, but that such inflation may expose the economy to the terrible risk of galloping inflation, particularly after full employment is achieved. Turn please to page 8. I'll deal finally with the matter of the effects of inflation upon debt and creditors. Just a paragraph above it. Anyone who depends on a fixed income, teachers, pensioners, living on interest and bonds or annuities, is likely, as a result of inflation, to find himself with a falling real income as prices rise, and his salary won't stretch over the increased cost of living. If the cost of living falls, however, these people with their unchanged cash income can buy a third more than they previously could. In a real sense, they are one third better off. Conversely, when prices rise, people with fixed incomes lose. For other people, especially those dependent upon profits, such as businessmen, incomes may fluctuate more than prices. As prices rise, their incomes rise even faster, and their real standard of living goes up. In depression, their income falls drastically, and they are worse off even if prices fall somewhat. Underline the next point. Inflation, then, tends to redistribute income from those with fixed incomes to those with rapidly increasing incomes. Deflation favors those with fixed incomes over those whose incomes fall rapidly. Now, because debts are fixed in monetary value, debtors gain and creditors lose when prices rise. The value of money in terms of which the debt is defined has fallen, so the debtor pays and the creditor has to accept a lower real value in payment. Creditors are in fact defrauded by inflation. On the other side of the picture, the debtor gains by being able to pay up his debt in depreciated dollars. If prices are falling, the reverse is true. Debtors lose and creditors gain. Inflation then tends to redistribute wealth from creditors to debtors. Deflation tends to shift it from debtors to creditors. At any given time, a large amount of debt is outstanding. In 1970, it was estimated there was $3 trillion worth of debt in the United States, including both personal, governmental, state, and local finance debt. Some of this huge debt has been contracted to finance the production of remunerative capital. For example, factories, houses, ships, and so on. The rest of the debt in existence merely represents the past extravagance of governments and individuals. It is possible to draw a distinction between the two varieties. Living debt, or capital debt, is borne by the remunerative assets it has helped to bring into being. Deadweight debt is, as its name implies, an obligation without offsetting assets. Now, every time the average level of prices falls, the number of goods and services represented by $100 of debt increases. The factory that the capital has built do not produce any fewer goods, but the goods sell for less money, since prices have fallen. Thus, the physical capital of the community can provide the service in a smaller proportion of the debt outstanding, and the real burden of the deadweight debt is increased. The gain of the man with a fixed income is his debtor's loss. Too rapid or extensive a fall of prices would raise to an intolerable degree the burden of deadweight debt and lead, at the best, to widespread bankruptcies or, at the worst, to social disturbance. This, more than any other factor, is probably the explanation of the fact the general tendency of prices throughout history has been steadily upwards. For example, the price of a bushel of wheat in 1050 was about 10 cents in the reign of William the Conqueror and about 60 cents in 1938. Only by a periodic rise in prices, that is, by a fall in the value of money, has the community been able to escape from being choked by debt and usury. From this point of view, inflation can even be seen as the judgment of Almighty God upon a godless financial system whose very lifeblood is debt and usury. Without inflation and a rise in prices, the American people would long ago become enslaved to the money power of the world. Nowhere was God's judgment more conspicuous than in post-war Germany after 1918. The money lenders had capitalized and monetized the debts of the German people in fighting the war. And as an aside, I should point out a lot of these money lenders, unfortunately for themselves, happened to belong to the tribe of Judah. And this explains why there was such great resentment against the Jews in Germany. But of course, the historians over here never point that fact out. Anyway, after the war, these money lenders thought they could live on their ill-gotten earnings. Instead, God humbled them and indeed destroyed them in the greatest inflation the world has ever known. And one of the main reasons I think the German people went along with Hitler's policy of extermination of the Jews was the fact they'd experienced the miseries brought upon them by the Jewish financiers. And they simply could not forget, especially the middle class, which is wiped out. I don't know whether Hitler was right in blaming the Jews entirely, but this is something we have to understand in understanding the behavior of the German people during that period. Now, this consideration should be borne in mind when the advantage of falling prices to the creditor is under discussion. The Bible makes it quite clear in Exodus 22, verses 25 to 27, that multiple indebtedness is contrary to God's law. Debt, underlined, must not be incurred beyond the value of one's immediate assets. I talk more about this tomorrow. A man, and by implication an institution, should not mortgage his future beyond very definite limits. This protects the creditor from overextending loans to unreliable and basically wasteful debtors, and it protects the debtor from going into debt beyond his reasonable capacity to repay his debt. By disregarding these fundamental principles, modern society has invited the judgments of the living God of the Bible, whose form takes that of inflation and a rise in price levels. Thus God turns even man's wrath and disobedience to his own praise and glory. Man cannot climb out from under the great principles and laws governing the economic law sphere, especially the law of scarcity. And I think with that, I'll stop.